Chapter 96. It is necessary at this juncture to return to you, who, having, as we have seen, called to the rioters to disperse from about the warren and meet again as usual, glided back into the darkness from which he had emerged, and reappeared no more that night. He paused in the copse which sheltered him from the observation of his mad companions, and waited to ascertain whether they drew off at his bidding, or still lingered and called to him to join them. Some few, he saw, were indisposed to go away without him, and made towards the spot where he stood concealed, as though they were about to follow in his footsteps, and urge him to come back. But these men, being in their turn called to by their friends, and in truth not greatly caring to venture into the dark parts of the grounds, where they might be easily surprised and taken, if any of the neighbors or retainers of the family were watching them from among the trees, soon abandoned the idea, and hastily assembling such men as they found of their mind at the moment, straggled off. When he was satisfied that the great mass of the insurgents were imitating this example, and that the ground was rapidly clearing, he plunged into the thickest portion of the little wood, and, crashing the branches as he went, made straight towards a distant light, guided by that, and by the sullen glow of the fire behind him. As he drew nearer and nearer to the twinkling beacon towards which he bent his course, the red glare of a few torches began to reveal itself, and the voices of men speaking together in a subdued tone broke the silence which, save for a distant shouting now and then, already prevailed. At length he cleared the wood, and, springing across a ditch, stood in a dark lane, where a small body of ill-looking vagabonds, whom he had left there some 20 minutes before, waited his coming with impatience. They were gathered round an old postchaise or chariot, driven by one of themselves, who sat postillion-wise upon the near horse. The blinds were drawn up, and Mr. Tappertit and Dennis kept guard at the two windows. The former assumed the command of the party, for he challenged Hugh as he advanced towards them. And when he did so, those who were resting on the ground about the carriage rose to their feet and clustered round him. "Well, ..." said Simon, in a low voice, "is all right?"
"Right enough,"
replied Hugh, in the same tone. "Their dispersing now had begun, before I came away." "And is the coast clear?"
"Clear enough before our men, I take it,"
said Hugh. "There are not many who, knowing of their work over yonder, will want to meddle with them tonight. Who's got some drink here?"
"Everybody had some plunder from the cellar. Half a dozen flasks and bottles were offered directly." He selected the largest, and putting it to his mouth, sent the wine gurgling down his throat. Having emptied it, he threw it down, and stretched out his hand for another, which he emptied likewise, at a draught. Another was given him, and this he half emptied too. Reserving what remained to finish with, he asked, "Have you got anything to eat, any of you? I'm as ravenous as a hungry wolf. Which of you was in the larder come?"
"I was, brother," said Dennis, pulling off his hat, and fumbling in the crown. "There's a matter of cold venison pasty somewhere or another here, if that'll do."
Cried Hugh, seating himself on the pathway.
"Bring it out. Quick. Show a light here, and gather round. Let me sup in state, my lads. Ha ha ha."
Entering into his boisterous humor, for they all had drunk deeply, and were as wild as he, they crowded about him, while two of their number who had torches, held them up, one on either side of him, that his banquet might not be dispatched in the dark. Mr. Dennis, having by this time succeeded in extricating from his hat a great mass of pasty, which had been wedged in so tightly that it was not easily got out, put it before him. And Hugh, having borrowed a notched and jagged knife from one of the company, fell to work upon it vigorously. "I should recommend you to swallow a little fire every day, about an hour before dinner, brother," said Dennis, after a pause. It seems to agree with you, and to stimulate your appetite. Apostrophe, you looked at him, and at the blackened faces by which he was surrounded, and, stopping for a moment, to flourish his knife above his head, answered with a roar of laughter. Keep order, there, will you? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Simon Tappertit. Why, isn't a man allowed to regale himself, noble captain? Apostrophe, retorted his lieutenant, parting the men who stood between them, with his knife, that he might see him, to regale himself a little bit after such work as mine. What a hard captain! What a strict captain! What a tyrannical captain! Ha ha ha! Apostrophe, I wish one of you fellers would hold a bottle to his mouth to keep him quiet. Apostrophe, said Simon, unless you want the military to be down upon us. Apostrophe, and what if they are down upon us? Apostrophe, apostrophe, retorted Hugh. Who cares? Who's afraid? Let 'em come, I say, let 'em come. The more, the merrier. Give me bold Barnaby at my side, and we two will settle the military, without troubling any of you. Barnaby's the man for the military. Barnaby's health. Apostrophe, but as the majority of those present were by no means anxious for a second engagement that night, being already weary and exhausted, they sided with Mr. Tappertit, and pressed him to make haste with his supper, for they had already delayed too long. Knowing, even in the height of his frenzy, that they incurred great danger, by lingering so near the scene of the late outrages, Hugh made an end of his meal without more remonstrance, and rising, stepped up to Mr. Tappertit, and smote him on the back. Now then, apostrophe, he cried, I'm ready. There are brave birds inside this cage, eh? Delicate birds, tender, loving, little doves. I caged them one more peep. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he thrust the little man aside as he spoke, and mounting on the steps, which were half let down, pulled down the blind by force, and stared into the chaise like an ogre into his larder. Ha ha ha! And did you scratch, and pinch, and struggle, pretty mistress? Apostrophe, apostrophe, he cried, as he grasped a little hand that sought in vain to free itself from his grip. You, so bright-eyed, and cherry-lipped, and daintily made? But I love you better for it, mistress. Eh, I do. You should stab me and welcome, so that it pleased you, and you had to cure me afterwards. I love to see you proud and scornful. It makes you handsomer than ever. And who so handsome as you at any time, my pretty one? Apostrophe, apostrophe, come. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Tappertit, who had waited during this speech with considerable impatience. There's enough of that. Come down. Apostrophe, the little hand seconded this admonition, by thrusting Hugh's great head away with all its force, and drawing up the blind, amidst his noisy laughter, and vows that he must have another look, for the last glimpse of that sweet face had provoked him past all bearing. However, as the suppressed impatience of the party now broke out into open murmurs, he abandoned this design, and taking his seat upon the bar, contented himself with tapping at the front windows of the carriage, and trying to steal a glance inside. Mr. Tappertit, mounting the steps and hanging on by the door, issued his directions to the driver with a commanding voice and attitude. The rest got up behind, or ran by the side of the carriage, as they could. Some, in imitation of Hugh, endeavored to see the face he had praised so highly, and were reminded of their impertinence by hints from the cudgel of Mr. Tappertit. Thus they pursued their journey by circuitous and winding roads, preserving, except when they halted to take breath, or to quarrel about the best way of reaching London, pretty good order and tolerable silence. In the meantime, Dolly Beautiful, bewitching, captivating little Dolly, her hair disheveled, her dress torn, her dark eyelashes wet with tears, her bosom heaving, her face, now pale with fear, now crimsoned with indignation, her whole self a hundred times more beautiful in this heightened aspect than ever she had been before, vainly strove to comfort Emma Haredale, and to impart to her the consolation of which she stood in so much need herself. The soldiers were sure to come. They must be rescued. It would be impossible to convey them through the streets of London when they set the threats of their guards at defiance and shrieked to the passengers for help. If they did this, when they came into the more frequented ways, she was quite certain they must be released. So poor Dolly said, and so poor Dolly tried to think. But the invariable conclusion of all such arguments was that Dolly burst into tears, cried, as she wrung her hands, what would they do or think, or who would comfort them, at home, at the Golden Key, and sobbed most piteously. Miss Airedale, whose feelings were usually of a quieter kind than Dolly's, and not so much upon the surface, was dreadfully alarmed, and indeed had only just recovered from a swoon. She was very pale, and the hand which Dolly held was quite cold, but she bade her, nevertheless, remember that, under Providence, much must depend upon their own discretion, that if they remained quiet, and lulled the vigilance of the ruffians into whose hands they had fallen, the chances of their being able to procure assistance, when they reached the town, were very much increased. That unless society were quite unhinged, a hot pursuit must be immediately commenced, and that her uncle, she might be sure, would never rest until he had found them out and rescued them. But as she said these latter words, the idea that he had fallen in a general massacre of the Catholics, that night no very wild or improbable supposition, after what they had seen and undergone struck her dumb. And, lost in the horrors they had witnessed, and those they might be yet reserved for, she sat incapable of thought, or speech, or outward show of grief. As rigid, and almost as white and cold, as marble. Oh, how many, many times, in that long ride, did Dolly think of her old lover, poor, fond, slighted Joe. How many, many times, did she recall that night, when she ran into his arms from the very man now projecting his hateful gaze into the darkness where she sat, and leering through the glass in monstrous admiration. And when she thought of Joe, and what a brave fellow he was, and how he would have rode boldly up, and dashed in among these villains now, yes, though they were double the number, and here she clenched her little hand, and pressed her foot upon the ground, the pride she felt for a moment in having won his heart, faded in a burst of tears, and she sobbed more bitterly than ever. As the night wore on, and they proceeded by ways which were quite unknown to them, for they could recognize none of the objects, of which they sometimes caught a hurried glimpse, their fears increased, nor were they without good foundation. It was not difficult for two beautiful young women to find, in their being born they knew, not whither by a band of daring villains who eyed them as some among these fellows did, reasons for the worst alarm. When they at last entered London, by a suburb with which they were wholly unacquainted, it was past midnight, and the streets were dark and empty. Nor was this the worst, for the carriage stopping in a lonely spot, Hugh suddenly opened the door, jumped in, and took his seat between them. It was in vain they cried for help. He put his arm about the neck of each, and swore to stifle them with kisses, if they were not as silent as the grave. I come here to keep you quiet, apostrophe he said, and that's the means I shall take. So don't be quiet, pretty mistresses make a noise do, and I shall like it all the better. Apostrophe, they were proceeding at a rapid pace, and apparently with fewer attendants than before, though it was so dark, the torches being extinguished, that this was mere conjecture. They shrunk from his touch, each into the farthest corner of the carriage. But shrink as Dolly would, his arm encircled her waist, and held her fast. She neither cried nor spoke, for terror and disgust deprived her of the power, but she plucked at his hand, as though she would die in the effort to disengage herself, and crouching on the ground, with her head averted and held down, repelled him with a strength she wondered at as much as he. The carriage stopped again. Lift this one out, apostrophe said Hugh to the man who opened the door, as he took Miss Airedale's hand, and felt how heavily it fell. She's fainted. Apostrophe, so much the better, apostrophe growled Dennis, it was that amiable gentleman. She's quiet. I always like 'em to faint, unless they're very tender and composed. Apostrophe, can you take her by yourself? Apostrophe, apostrophe, ask you. I don't know till I try. I ought to be able to. I've lifted up a good many in my time, apostrophe, said the hangman. Up then. She's no small weight, brother. None of these here fine gals are. Up again. Now we have her. Apostrophe, having by this time hoisted the young lady into his arms, he staggered off with his burden. Looky, pretty bird, apostrophe, said Hugh, drawing Dolly towards him. Remember what I told you, a kiss for every cry. Scream, if you love me, darling. Scream once, mistress. Pretty mistress, only once, if you love me. Apostrophe, thrusting his face away with all her force, and holding down her head, Dolly submitted to be carried out of the chaise, and borne after Miss Airedale into a miserable cottage, where Hugh, after hugging her to his breast, set her gently down upon the floor. Poor Dolly! Do what she would, she only looked the better for it, and tempted them the more. When her eyes flashed angrily, and her ripe lips slightly parted, to give her rapid breathing vent, who could resist it? When she wept and sobbed, as though her heart would break, and bemoaned her miseries in the sweetest voice that ever fell upon a listener's ear, who could be insensible to the little winning pettishness which now and then displayed itself, even in the sincerity and earnestness of her grief? When, forgetful for a moment of herself, as she was now, she fell on her knees beside her friend, and bent over her, and laid her cheek to hers, and put her arms about her, what mortal eyes could have avoided wandering to the delicate bodice, the streaming hair, the neglected dress, the perfect abandonment and unconsciousness of the blooming little beauty? Who could look on, and see her lavish caresses and endearments, and not desire to be in Emma Airedale's place, to be either her or Dolly, either the hugging or the hugged? Not you. Not Dennis. I tell you what it is, young women, apostrophe, said Mr. Dennis, I ain't much of a ladies' man myself, nor am I a party in the present business further than lending a willing hand to my friends. But if I see much more of this here sort of thing, I shall become a principal instead of a accessory. I tell you candid. Apostrophe, why have you brought us here? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Emma. Are we to be murdered? Apostrophe, apostrophe, murdered. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Dennis, sitting down upon a stool, and regarding her with great favor. Why, my dear, who'd murder sich chickabiddies as you? If you was to ask me, now, whether you was brought here to be married, there might be something in it. Apostrophe, and here he exchanged a grin with Hugh, who removed his eyes from Dolly for the purpose. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.